Coming up on this edition of the Black Vault Radio, New York Times best-selling author Annie Jacobson steps into the vault to talk about the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. Her book, The Pentagon's Brain, dives deep into this secret, powerful, and controversial military science R&D agency. Annie joins me to explore whether she believes that the mind control programs of the 1960s are still going on today.
DARPA started a new program that I write about with a drug, which would then work to shift soldiers' perspectives about morality. This particular brain program was the program that DARPA itself called my publisher, and made a move to keep me from talking about it. We're able to regrow the digit on a mouse or a pig. That's huge science. Like 10 years ago, that was unheard of. Now they can do it. I am absolutely certain that more stories will come out of people that we don't even know about, that are buried.
All that and much more. So stay tuned. The Black Vault Radio is about to begin. More than 20 years ago, I began a journey, my quest for the truth. My name is John Greenwald, and I have hammered the United States government with Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to get answers. I have more than 2 million pages of declassified documents for you to download at theblackvault.com. Now, I attempt to dive even deeper and talk to some of the most brilliant minds on this planet. No government secret is off limits, and no question is off the table. All I aim for is the truth. This is the Black Vault Radio. That's right, everybody. This is the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr., as always. Thank you so much for making this your podcast and radio show of choice. It never fails this time of the year here as we approach Christmas already here in 2018, and then 2019 is quickly around the corner. Never fails. I always need to get sick. I don't know if it is just a ticking time bomb within me that says, oh, it is the holiday season. All right, bring on the flus and colds. So I apologize for my voice just a little bit, but this episode is something pretty important and I did not want to delay it. As some of you have been watching, as I post on social media on Twitter and also on Facebook, there has been an incredible amount of attention to the new MKUltra and the behavioral modification documents from the CIA that I received just weeks ago. I have fought for years for these things. You have heard me talk about it on the program. And I was amazed to see the media reaction. If you haven't been following, let me tell you just very briefly. So I got these documents, thousands of pages of behavioral modification research that the CIA did. And this made headlines around the world. It arguably started with The Sun. I believe that was the first major media outlet that profiled these things. It ended up on the number one spot on DrudgeReport.com. Obviously, one of the most coveted spots on the internet when it comes to news. It stayed there for days. That was on a Friday. It was there through Sunday. And then all of a sudden, Monday and Tuesday, another story popped up from Newsweek. Again, there was quite a few stories about this, but a new one then focused in on one of the documents. And this was all about implants into dogs' brains. That if you can believe it, the CIA was successful, wasn't a failure. It was successful in implanting implants into dogs' brains and successfully, in essence, remote controlling them, controlling their mind telling them where to go, which direction. And Newsweek did an excellent job profiling this. Well, that one ended up in the number one spot on Drudge Report again. The attention was insane. And then all of a sudden, you know, I hate to say it this way, but this is what it is. Copy and paste journalism took over and it just went everywhere, went global, thanks to Newsweek. Well, today they did it again. They're publishing a story about a dossier about an otter. And they studied this otter and they went into great detail in this dossier. And the document was profiled again in Newsweek. I'll link that in the show notes. But wow, was it just a huge reaction to it. If you have not seen those documents, I highly recommend to do so. I'll link them over at the show notes, www.theblackvault.com/show notes. Now, if you are interested in that, then you're going to love today's show. In quite a few interviews that I did, one namely, which was very controversial that I appeared anyway, but one interview that this came up the most was when Alex Jones had asked me to appear on his program and talk about these documents. Now, I agreed. Obviously, I've spoken about some of the things that Alex Jones has said in the past. I don't necessarily agree with them, but I do have respect for the fact that he wanted to get the story right. Instead of just talking about it, he wanted to talk to me. Now, I respect that. Doesn't matter what media outlet wants to do that. They want to cover it the right way. Then they have my respect. And of course, given maybe some rare circumstances, I'll generally agree to come on the program. Well, in that interview, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, came up a lot. These documents that I received from the CIA were from the 1950s, the 1960s, and some from the 1970s. We know that this research was going on then. What we don't know is if it's still going on today. Some, like Alex Jones, believes absolutely, hands down, it is, and that's fine. Others, like myself, well, there's not a whole lot of evidence yet when it comes to official documents to really support the continuation of that research today. So I thought, since we, you know, we're talking about DARPA, and that if this was going on, if this was something that is continuing today, DARPA would be the place that it was doing it at. That the government would be housing this research within DARPA, maybe even sugarcoating it, that they're doing it for the good and better of humanity. But it is, in essence, the continuation of MKUltra, mind control, behavioral modification, and literally the implantation of these mechanical devices, these computer chips, in the brains of animals and, quite possibly, human beings, because you're fast-forwarding decades. Well, I thought it would be fun to have the world's leading expert on DARPA, literally the one who wrote the book about all of the secret programs that DARPA has done. Her name is Annie Jacobson. Her book is The Pentagon's Brain. This is one of many books that ended her up on the New York Times bestseller list for her different books, one on Area 51, most recently Phenomena. She has done a lot of research. So I'm going to pick her brain a little bit about DARPA, what it's done in the past, and quite possibly what it's doing now. So she's coming up in just a couple of minutes. Now, quickly, if you did not listen to last week's special edition of the Black Vault Radio, I had Dr. Seth Shostak on, and I wanted to talk about this for a minute. Now, some of you, not all of you, but some of you wanted me to turn that interview into a cage match. We all know Dr. Shostak is fairly skeptical when it comes to UFOs and anything paranormal. As if you don't know, Dr. Shostak is the lead astronomer, the senior astronomer at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI Institute. They're the ones that we know popularly by the organization that monitors radio waves and looks for signals from another world. Well, I picked his brain a little bit on why radio, because obviously that's a big skeptical argument that they're wasting time and money. He had a good answer for that, in my opinion, and went into detail. But obviously he dismissed, when we got onto UFOs, the UFO field as a whole. Now, I'm secure in my beliefs. I got evidence to back up what I say. So it doesn't bother me if somebody says they don't believe it. That's fine. I invited him on to explore not only SETI, but also just to kind of hear what he thought about the UFO phenomenon. But it was not a debate. I did not invite him on, and I told him that outright, that I was not going to turn it into a debate. I think he was probably well aware of my background. But I didn't want to just, you know, turn it into a cage match. And sadly, I think some of you listening wanted me to do that. This is just a friendly reminder about this show that this is a place to explore ideas, ones that I may not necessarily agree with or you may not necessarily agree with. But it is a place to invite people on to talk about their research, to talk about what they believe and why they believe it. Now, I'm sure we'll have heavy debate shows here, and I'm not afraid to ask questions. That's why Dr. Shostak and I talked about UFOs. But there was one exchange, part of the exchange, that I wanted to play back for you, that even Dr. Shostak, who was more approaching it from a skeptical or even a debunking angle, had an excellent point that I want to bring up and make sure that you all picked up on. Now, just for a little bit of context, I had asked him, this was based on a new report that was authored by a SETI scientist, and it had said that we should look into UFO reports a little bit closer. Now, of course, the media glommed onto this and got a little bit embellished, so I had Dr. Shostak tell us kind of exactly what it said. But in black and white, it said that maybe we are missing something, that maybe we should analyze these UFO cases, the UFO evidence, just to see what's there. So I had asked Dr. Shostak, despite his kind of negative view on the UFO phenomenon and what he believes is a lack of evidence, will the SETI Institute shift its policy towards that? Even though present day it does not look at UFO reports and that's not part of its research angle, will they ever, based on, you know, here as a NASA scientist, somebody involved in SETI, saying, hey, we should look at this evidence, will SETI ever shift that view on the UFO phenomenon? Take a listen, because this is actually pretty important, and I'll tell you why, but this is what he said.
Well, somebody wants to spend the money to do it. You know, I don't know that the SETI Institute will be doing it anytime soon, mm-hmm. if ever, because it's not, to begin with, there's not the expertise, right? The kind of expertise you need for this sort of thing is not the sort of thing that an astronomer would have, for example. It's, you know, expertise and, well, can you recognize what actually might be the glint off an aircraft at high altitude from, you know, these measures, whatever they are, or that sort of thing. So, you know, it requires a different sort of expertise.
Now, that is what Dr. Shostak said. Now, obviously, he is approaching this from a debunking angle where he says those experts will, you know, figure out light reflections in a lens or how to explain UFOs. Here's what I picked up on, and I'm not trying to put words in his mouth, but I think it's very important, and it's something that I feel that the general public and the UFO community often misses. Scientists are very much in a niche group of research studies, that they generally are not this wide-ranging field of studies, that they really hone in on one specialty, and that's their angle. Now, arguably, one of the most famous UFO investigators is going to be kind of revived when it comes to the history books, is going to be on the History Channel. That's Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Now, he was an astronomer. He was somebody with that background that became convinced. I think he's kind of a rare case, though. And what Dr. Shostak was saying was that you just don't want an astronomer looking at that type of data. Now, obviously, he's coming in from a skeptical point of view. So he feels those experts that are qualified can pretty much debunk anything out there. What I take away from that is he's absolutely right, but not necessarily from a debunking angle. You need a certain niche study to look at the data. Does astronomy play a role? Absolutely, sure, in small part. Does astrobiology? Yeah, now you're getting a little bit closer. And I think you have to bridge multiple people from multiple backgrounds to truly understand the phenomena itself, that you truly have to understand astronomy, astrobiology, astrophysics, and of course, mechanical objects. What can traverse the stars? Artificial intelligence, computer programming. it's going to take a lot of backgrounds to truly understand this. That's what I walked away from that part of the interview. And I bring that up just to also reinforce why I don't turn these interviews into cage matches. He's not going to be convinced over what I say, and that's okay. I have a lot of respect for Dr. Shostak, and I hope you all do as well after that interview. But it's being able to ask those questions when you get those types of answers that things start to make sense a little bit more. That even though he doesn't agree with you or me or whomever when it comes to the UFO phenomenon, he's saying that I'm not the right one to look at it. I think he's more than qualified to if he sat down and he looked at the evidence. But let's keep in mind, he's an astronomer and he's approaching this from a very wildly different angle. So I have respect for him saying that says, hey, look, I don't see the evidence, but at the end of the day, there needs to be a different type of expert to take a look at all of this. So I hope you see what I mean with those interviews, but I wanted to replay that for you. If you had not heard the interview, definitely listen to this one with Annie Jacobson coming right up. But also go back and take a listen to Dr. Seth Shostak, because SETI is so much more than those scientists depicted in the movies listening on their headsets waiting for aliens to send a message. It goes much deeper than that, and they do a lot of other research. So I hope you got something out of that interview, and if you haven't listened to it yet, definitely go back and do so. All right, so that being said, Annie Jacobson, author of The Pentagon's Brain and quite a few other books, which we will get into, is coming right up on the TBV Dialogue segment. Stay tuned. In this episode's TBV Dialogue segment, I welcome investigative journalist and New York Times best-selling author Annie Jacobson. Annie is the author of Area 51, Operation Paperclip, The Pentagon's Brain, and most recently Phenomena, all of which landed her on the New York Times bestseller lists. Her work has been translated into 16 different languages, and it was her work with The Pentagon's Brain, the topic, or at least the main one anyway, of this episode of the Black Vault Radio, made her a 2016 Pulitzer Prize finalist in the category of history. She also writes and produces television, currently Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan airing on Amazon Prime, and the forthcoming Phenomena series. Annie, it's amazing background that you have. Welcome to the Black Vault Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It's an honor to have you on. I've known about your work for many years, obviously. Anybody who's a listener to this program is going to be a fan of your books if they aren't already. I know you've got a very busy schedule, and I know you did me a little bit of a favor by coming on this week. The reason why I wanted to have you on, though, is, as you know, there have been quite a few documents that have come out from the 50s, 60s, and 70s shedding light on mind control and behavioral modification. And there's a theory out there that DARPA, if this is all continuing on today, that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, would be kind of where it all is still going on. Or at least that's the theory anyway. So I figured, hey, I'm not an expert on that agency, but why not have the foremost expert on it, and that would be you. So thank you so much for joining me. For those who are listening that don't know, can you tell everybody what DARPA is?
DARPA stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and it is the most powerful, most productive military science agency in the world, has been since the late 50s, and no, almost no one knows what it is. So right there, I think it kind of tells you what's behind the behind.
Yeah, and why is that? I mean, you very rarely hear about it. You hear about the main agencies, the DOD and the CIA, and now more so the NSA. What really is going on within DARPA's walls?
When DARPA was first started during the Eisenhower administration, and there was kind of this big debate about whether the agency should even exist, the Secretary of Defense, his name was McElroy at the time, SecDef McElroy, went before Congress and he said, our job is to create the vast weapon systems of the future. And that was true then, and that is true today. So wherever we are in time, if you read my books, and of course they're history, wherever you are, if you're in the 60s reading about the 60s, you realize, my God, DARPA was in the 80s already, and, you know, so on and so forth. And so where DARPA is now is 20 years in the future, 25 years in the future. And the book, I think some of the most frightening parts about it really are at the end, when I do write about some of these autonomous weapons programs, many of which have to do with the brain. They're called brain-computer interface programs. It's the idea of merging man and machine, using man's mind to control the weapons of the future. And they are already looking 25 years out. They're already working on those projects, and those projects are in R&D. Some of them are classified. Many of them are in the early stages, and I was able to report on that by interviewing scientists who are working on those early stages, many of which who actually don't really know what their programs are for.
And that's, I want to compliment you on this. I've said this a couple times to a few of the guests that I have on, and I mean this for you. I am a big fan of those that do original research. And what I mean by that is, a lot of times a book will come out and you read it, and they're really using research from somebody else, and then they put their own spin on it or add an opinion or an ad lib or something. You are going out there doing interviews, and quite a few of them, people are talking to you, and you're digging in deeper than I think anybody has ever dug into DARPA before. Can you talk about who exactly you spoke with to write this book and figure out what DARPA was all about?
Well, I think, I mean, thank you for the lovely compliment. I do also, as I write in my acknowledgments, so much credit must go to those who came before me, specific people, I mean, and, you know, I cite them all always in my notes. My books are about 500 pages, and there's 100 pages of notes, because there are some amazing researchers, journalists, historians who look, you know, with a microscope at certain areas and write what almost gets, could be called like academic, you know, writing. And so it kind of gets shunted off into the bowels of academia. And not a lot of people read it, but I wind up in those texts from the people I interview. And that is where I get so much amazing information. And I simply couldn't write my books without that, because of, yes, I interview people, and I tend to interview older scientists, certainly for Pentagon's Brain. I interviewed, to be specific here, there's a group of men called the Jason Scientists. And anybody who's a conspiracy theorist or anyone who likes looking into conspiracies is probably familiar with the Jasons, because they are kind of like often thought of as like the Illuminati of very smart scientists and engineers. And I found, while I was researching and reporting the Pentagon's Brain, a little bit of a different story behind that. For example, Murph Goldberger founded the Jasons. He was alive while I was reporting the book. He died right before the book published, but I interviewed him at great length about the early origins of the Jasons. They were called the supermen of science, and they would work during the year at America's sort of foremost, most prestigious universities, Princeton, Berkeley, Harvard, Columbia. During the year, they acted as professors, and during the summers, they would get together for DARPA. Then it was called ARPA. There was no D for defense yet. And they would solve these allegedly impossible, you know, problems that the Defense Department was trying to solve so as to create the vast weapon systems of the future. And they did this, you know, they would gather in these very, you know, sort of lovely ways. And one of the guys had a beautiful summer home up on an island in Maine, you know, and they'd sort of eat lobsters around an old, I mean, literally, right? You know, cracking open lobsters and discussing physics. Wow. How can we create, you know, the MIRV, what became the multiple reentry warhead, a 10 warheaded nuclear weapon that could basically just like start, you know, the apocalypse. They would come up with the theoretical ideas behind those weapon systems, you know, sitting around in the summer brainstorming. And I tell the story of them in the book, because it's very important, because it takes a very dark and macabre turn at the end of all that in the present day, but I don't want to get there yet.
And were the people that you interviewed part of this scientific community known as the Jason Group? I mean, were they involved in that, or was this kind of the upper echelon of DARPA? I mean, talk to me about who was willing to go on the record with you, and did you have a struggle getting them to talk about some of these, I would assume anyway, highly classified programs?
Yes, well, that's always what's true. I mean, many, many people talk to me. I mean, I think there's 86 scientists, you know, formerly top secret cleared scientists. I mean, Murph Goldberger, for example, when we were interviewing, I went down and interviewed him at sort of like what I called an old folks home, you know, in San Diego, looking out over the ocean. And just 10 miles away, you've got a defense contractor, General Dynamics, who has the Jason SCIF facility. A SCIF is a secret compartmented information facility, and it's, you know, no electronics can get into it, and they have a SCIF for the Jason scientists where they gather. While I was interviewing Murph Goldberger, there he is, I think he was 90 at the time, 91 maybe, you know, the phone rings, and it was the guys over at DARPA wanting to know if he wanted to come and sort of do, like, you know, a sort of Professor Emeritus, you know, kind of like a, almost like a celebrity appearance at their meeting that was taking place right then. Goldberger still had his top secret clearance, aid in 91, because they would still reach out to him for consulting issues on occasion. And so, yes, that part of it is always remarkable, and I find that intriguing, interesting, fascinating, confusing, all of the above when I'm interviewing people who I think are formerly top clear. You know, I know they've had their clearances for decades, but I would assume that the word former would be in front of that. And then the phone rings, and in fact, they're still active. And that is the case with every one of the books I have written. I have found out that they are often kept on to consult. Now, are they acutely aware of what they can and cannot tell a reporter like myself? Yes. Herein lies the great non-mystery, which is actually great for a reporter, which is that many of these programs become declassified, and yet the public's interest in them has waned or been lost, mm-hmm. right? Like what you found with the brain, the stemocevers, they're called, the brain implants. That's a perfect example. I've come across a whole bunch of those documents, and the scientist who created that program named Jose Delgado for the CIA. But these things are sort of buried in, you know, history, and they only become interesting when someone like yourself, you know, makes it known, and people go, my God, what the hell is going on here? And in fact, it is like, I think I read somewhere, reading about some of the work you're doing, someone said, you know, I think it was a Newsweek journalist talking about you, mentioned how you're able to bring these things long forgotten to the public's attention.
Yeah, and it does take a lot of work, as you know, and it's like they don't want the 50, the 60 plus year ago research programs to see the light of day. And that to me is the most terrifying, not necessarily, and this got the most press out of the documents, but not necessarily that they're putting, you know, implants into dogs' brains and able to control them and moved in different directions. But that was in the 1960s, you know. Fast forward to 2018, you've got an agency like DARPA. Yeah, it's fascinating to see what they did in the 60s, but it's absolutely terrifying to know what they might be doing today. And you, before our show here, you and I were chatting, and you brought up Delgado and the research that they were doing, and the fact that, you know, this was obviously very newsworthy on a global scale that they did with dogs. But that was only the tip of the iceberg, right? I mean, you found a lot more than that of putting implants into other animals as well, right?
Absolutely. But let's, just for anyone listening, let's jump to the present tense, because that's always super interesting. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes we go back in history and go, okay, guys, here's where it all began. Here's the origin story. So, just in terms of, because you're absolutely right, it seems anachronistic. It's like, oh, those weird programs they did chips in monkeys' brains in the 50s. How weird of them. Well, what does that mean today? Well, here's what it means today, okay? So DARPA, right in the last years of the Obama administration, the White House announced what it called a BRAIN initiative. And BRAIN, B-R-A-I-N, stood for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. I mean, what a lovely sounding project. And it's what the press releases were, how this was going to cure Alzheimer's and schizophrenia and, you know, every kind of, every civilian's worst nightmare that their grandparent suffers. This is what this was all about. And it sounded great, but if you looked behind the curtain only one degree, as I did, you found out who is their partner in this. DARPA. Well, wait a minute. That's where I go full stop. DARPA's mission statement is to build the vast weapon systems of the future. That is not about curing Alzheimer's. And so in that little tiny representation, you can see how it works. It is the kind of wrapping the beneficent or burying the potentially malignant or nefarious inside a beneficent idea. We're going to cure Alzheimer's. And that's what I take most issue with, because I think the lack of transparency is one thing, but kind of manipulating the jig is another. And so I looked deeper into that and, of course, found out that the program that DARPA is really leading on brain chips has to do, this is the 30-second version, you can read the 400-page version in the Pentagon's brain, but the short version is that you've got all these soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD and also with brain injuries, serious traumatic brain injuries, you know, ranging from amnesia to, you know, worse. And so DARPA creates a program where they're putting brain chips in the brain to then be able to monitor the brain in real time. Okay. There's a lot more science behind this, but I'm giving you the kind of narrative version of it. And they have these lovely names, each of the programs. Subnets, you know, it stands for a whole bunch of acronyms, right? RAM. RAM is Restoring Active Memory. I mean, that just sounds terrific. You got someone who comes home from the war, they're having amnesia, put a brain chip in their brain, let them remember what they have forgotten. Terrific. Except for that's not DARPA's job. That's the job of the VA to help soldiers. DARPA's job, say it again, vast weapon systems of the future. And so I dig a little deeper and present to the reader what this really is about is something called BCI, Brain Computer Interface. So you can study the brain. Yes, you can see how the brain chip works in the brain in real time. Scientists sitting in labs watching brain functions of people who have signed up for this program. And at the time that the book published a couple years ago, there were something like 12 active programs. And that what that leads to when you look at the bigger, broader DOD plan, it has to do with autonomous weapons, drones, being able to communicate directly with a soldier's brain. So there's no more button involved, essentially. And again, that's the short narrative version.
Yeah.
But you can begin to work directly within the autonomous weapon system. And what I found even more nefarious is that this idea is really deep at our morality, deep at our identities. All kinds of polls were taken, which I write about, and many people at the Pentagon, from the generals on down to the soldiers, were like, you know what, we don't want to do it that way. We don't like this movement in that direction. That was a majority vote. And so DARPA started a new program that I write about with a drug, which would then work to shift soldiers' perspectives about morality. And so you begin to see a broader picture where the DOD's vision is going to happen no matter what. In other words, they're going to make everyone around them conform to their idea, not take feedback and make their initiatives follow what a broader swath of individuals think is a good idea. And now here's where the real rub comes. That direction that I'm telling you about, mm-hmm. who is that? You say, well, wait a minute, whose direction is that? Who's the Wizard of Oz here? And I thought it was the Jason scientists. That is where my original reporter's nose was going. And I found out from sources, again, all sourced in the book, that in fact, the Jason scientists were originally in charge of all this, and they led the charge to say, this is a bad idea, we don't want to do it, we think it could lead to brain control. That's almost a direct quote.
Wow.
Okay? These are the old-timer scientists who are now in their 80s when this program was really taking off right after 9/11, and there was a huge influx of cash. The Jason scientists, the veteran scientists, the full-time professors, part-time defense scientists said, no, 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 we don't like this. And this is all documented in the book. And so what happened? The Jason scientists were moved out of pole position at DARPA. And in their place were put a new group of individuals called the Defense Science Board, the DSB. So now the DSB is leading the charge and leading the vision. And if you look at the list of the individuals who are in the DSB, the Defense Science Board, they're not brilliant professors from Berkeley and Columbia and Harvard and Princeton who are full-time professors and part-time defense scientists. They are full-time defense contractors.
Wow.
And behind every one of their names, or rather a comma after their names, is the CEO of Pacific Defense Contractors, like Boeing, like General Dynamics, right? Lockheed. And again, they're all specifically named in the book, but you go, oh my God, wait a minute. These guys are in charge of the vision. And so the dreadful feeling at the end of the Pentagon's brain is not that science is the enemy, but greed is.
And just for clarity for the audience, and I'll just be blunt. I mean, this is 21st century mind control with a different name?
Let's talk about what mind control actually means, mm-hmm. right? Are you talking about being able to send signals to someone's brain and make them turn left versus turn right?
Well, I think that that's part of it. And let me just quickly explain, and I'll pass it back to you. Where I feel that this is absolutely fascinating and absolutely terrifying all at the same time is that I know that they're linking computer interfaces with the brain. Now, they may be doing a short term, they want to cure this disease or turn off pain receptors or, you know, help with pain management or PTSD or whatever the objective is, right? If you take that to the next level, you will then be able to turn off morality. You will then be able to put artificial intelligence in those chips, activate the parts of your brain that make you into, you know, a super soldier, ultimate warrior kind of thing. Is it to make you turn left or right? Well, possibly, but more so to create a super soldier, somebody that doesn't have morality, that does not look at another human being and say, I can't kill them. To go to a very dark place because they control the parts of the mind that will, in essence, stop them from doing certain things. I don't mean to make it dark, but that's kind of where I think that a lot of this is going.
Well, yes, because if you're talking philosophically as you are, or theoretically rather, absolutely, you can make those assumptions. And that is what the Jason scientists warned against. They mm-hmm. said, you're opening up Pandora's box because a nefarious program director could do exactly all those things that you just stated, right? And the argument is always, and I do not mean that lightly, because remember, I'm the historian who looked at DARPA's programs from the early 1950s to the present. Mm-hmm. So when I say what they do, it's like I try to show readers, okay, they did it this way this year, then this happened, and this is how, you know, you see, aha, a pattern, okay? So someone comes up with an idea and the naysayer, like you, is what you just said. Wait a minute, we can't do this, it's super dark. And mm-hmm. they present what you just presented. And the first layer is always, well, we're not going to do that. We're the good guys. We're not going to do that. And we don't do that. Okay. And I, in many regards, I do believe that is often the intention. Okay. I don't believe the government is like inherently dark. But what happens almost always in my research is that then the enemy, and I say that because that's what they're called. So whether it's North Korea or the Russians or who, or the Vietnam, whoever gets the technology or steals the technology or mimics the technology or the training or the technique and begins to use it in a manner that is dark, that is nefarious, that has no democratic principles attached to it. And then the response from the DARPA is, well, they're doing that now, so we must combat that. We must, and this is a direct quote, fight fire with fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so you, it's impossible to create a weapon and not have it used against you. We know that in this world. And that's what one of the leading scientists at DARPA said to me. Well, Annie, we're often accused over here of creating a self-licking ice cream cone.
And I think that to go back what you said about fighting fire with fire, I think that that's where history plays such an important role into analyzing stuff like this and what they're doing in the present day. Because when you go back 30, 40, 50 years, you see what they've done. It then makes sense that they mastered doing these brain connections with animals. And once you master that, you're not going to just give up and say, well, this research was a success, but we're obviously not going to do it in humans. And that's where I go back with turning off the morality. And you brought it up yourself. The Jason group says, or the Jason scientist says, no, we can't do this. I know you didn't say this part. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. But in essence, in my opinion, they're saying we can't play God here. Like we're getting too smart with this. It's very dangerous and it can be dark. And that's the human morality part, that to military intelligence, you got to turn it off. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that that's the part that I think that they want to focus on and say, hey, wait a minute. We need to move forward with this. And that's where history plays a crucial role. Why? Because the mind control stuff started just that way. The Navy and the Army, I think, was the one that arguably was the one that started as a defensive mechanism because they knew the Soviets were doing it. They were trying to figure out how to extract information from captured American intelligence officers. So the CIA was, you know, thinking, hey, wait a minute, if they can do it, we got to do it first and better. And so that's where I think history plays kind of an important role in all of this. I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think that the Jason scientists kind of proved that they are what the military in a dark sense wants to stop. And that is the human emotion of stopping this type of research. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Well, absolutely. And there are two important points that you brought up. One is, you know, you look at history and you see, oh, all the Soviet techniques, which didn't really start out as quote unquote mind control. Mm-hmm. They really started out as just, you know, good old fashioned, let's get the information out of the guy, you know, which could be called torture. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was about in a very broad sense. But broad is sometimes easy to understand, right? So we're over there, in early 1950, when the CIA was just getting going, we set up a facility in a place called Oberursel in Germany, right after the war, at a place called Camp King, and specifically in a place called Haus Waldorf, and we started trying out all these drugs on Soviet prisoners that we captured that were believed to be intelligence agents. Now, you know, interestingly, how did we get those alleged spies? Well, they were given to us by, you know, an evil Nazi, Reinhard Galen, who worked for us now as part of Operation Paperclip. And Galen was saying, oh yes, this guy is a really, really bad guy. So it starts off on shaky ground of like, wait, who's deciding that this is a bad guy? Oh, this former murderous Nazi. Okay, and then let's try out these techniques on him. And then the Russians are looking, as they do, and spying, as they do, on Camp King and saying, oh my God, look what they're doing to us. Well, we need a better and a more nefarious, powerful drug to use against them, and so on and so forth. And things get, you know, the stakes ratchet up and the darkness ratchet up. And we know a lot about where that program went. And before you know it, people, you know, it metastasizes and then it becomes, you know, okay, well, let's see how this works in a prison patient, you know, who has no rights. And then things become stripped down to where elements of our government are acting like the enemy, you know, really acting in those kind of fascist terms that we're also afraid of. But one of, you know, going back to the present day program, one of the things that, and I would use this with my argument, you know, the DARPA book was interesting because this particular brain program was the program that DARPA itself called up my publisher rather, and made a move to keep me from talking about it. And it was only because I was able to demonstrate to them that I had made 12 overtures to their brain scientist program who wouldn't speak to me. And so then I went around them and spoke to some of the people in the program. But clearly this is a program that they do not want people to know about. And the real icing on the cake that felt dark to me had to do with the morality issue of it. And it went like this. Right around the time the Jason scientist said, we're not recommending you move in this direction. It could lead to high quality brain control. That's a quote. They, meaning DARPA, approached a neuroeconomist, named Dr. Paul Zak. And Zak had done his postdoctoral training at Harvard, and he was on television talking about how he had made this groundbreaking, life-changing discovery. He had discovered what he called, and I interviewed Zak, the brain's moral molecule, okay? So the chemical in the brain called oxytocin that allows man to make moral decisions tied to trust. And this, interestingly, is the actual chemical that is secreted by women when they breastfeed, okay? So it's so deeply biological. I mean, you have to have such, if you go back to like we're all animals and primates, right? Imagine a breastfeeding mother. I mean, that has to be an ultimate trust because you're totally exposed to the wildebeest that could attack you or the jaguar or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is like a serious discovery that Zak made, and then knock, 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 who comes to his door but DARPA. And they are interested in him, and they begin to work with him. And Dr. Zak insists that everything that was done was only to help soldiers make moral decisions. But I believe the opposite, and I report that because researchers at the University of Bonn who are not affiliated with DARPA took Zak's research and they took a totally different approach. They took the dark approach and they wanted to see if they could erase fear.
Oof.
Using that chemical component.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to. And they put it up the noses of 62 men to find out if they could make them not feel fear. And the quote was, for the most part, it worked.
That's absolutely terrifying, the implications behind that. I mean,
sorry, say that again.
It's terrifying.
I didn't mean to laugh, but it is.
Yeah. No, it absolutely is terrifying. I mean, with your research, do you believe that ultimately DARPA is trying to create a super soldier? Is that the end game? I mean, what do you think the end game is?
Well, there is no doubt. I mean, that is, you know, I think one of the things that I experience when I write my books is I start out like, oh, I wonder if they're trying to create a super soldier. And then you find out immediately, like, absolutely they are. And then, okay, so what does that mean? And mm-hmm. then I try to show, so you know, it's not like, oh my God, there's not some huge reveal like that. That's page one, unfortunately. And then it goes a bit deeper. And where I derive the most, let's say energy or like a quandary, you know, when your own brain is like, what the heck's going on here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is when you have to then confront the other side of the argument and it becomes even more complex and darker because the other side of the argument is they do it. They is the enemy, right? Okay. And then you have to really, as a reader, you have to ask yourself, well, what do I really think about all this? And then I think it becomes ultimately far more interesting than just shocking, right? And I'll give you a quote rather. That sounds a bit vague. So another thing I write a lot about in the book is about the ability that we have, and we probably do. We are probably cloning. I mean, that's a hypothetical of mine, but I write
cloning
about
humans.
Scientists who are, yes.
Okay.
I mean, because I write about the scientists who are doing everything right up to cloning humans, okay?
Wow.
That are growing new limbs for soldiers, mm-hmm. okay? In the future, again, don't forget, this is 25 years down the road. So the scientists I interview, you know, were able to regrow the digit on a mouse, you know, or a pig, okay? That's huge science. Like 10 years ago, that was unheard of. Now they can do it. Or create new limbs on salamanders. I saw in the lab, I saw salamanders with way too many limbs. Okay, how freaky is that?
Wow.
Right? I have pictures of them in the book. And scientists who are doing this earnest work, right, with limb regeneration. Think of all, again, going back to the Alzheimer's analogy, White House curing Alzheimer's, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the scientists believe that they are working on limb regeneration, but they are also the first to admit that they're getting their $5 million DARPA contract because guess what? That pays for their lab because not that many people are willing to fund limb regeneration for soldiers 20 years down the road,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so, but DARPA is. But what happens to their research? Well, a certain amount of the research is classified. And their research, the results of their research, goes away. Where does it go? It goes to DARPA, okay? And that's the door I can't get behind. You can't get behind. No mm-hmm. one can get behind because that's this really classified, because that's just one piece of the puzzle. So the extra limbs on the salamander are just one piece of the bigger picture. But anyways, going back to my point there about, well, you have to ask yourself the question. And so what those scientists said to me, the limb regenerators, they said, Annie, you know, before you get so naive here, and I'm paraphrasing. I mean, we're talking about really interesting, smart, ethical people, mm-hmm. okay, in my opinion. They said, what about if you wake up one morning and you find out that China or, you know, Iran or a dark horse like Saudi Arabia has cloned the first human? Everyone in America is going to say, wait a minute, where was DARPA?
Mm-hmm.
Or they come up with a weapon that we can't, you and I sitting here can't even conceive. But it's the equivalent of, like, you know, as I write in the book, drone technology goes way back to the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. I mean, way back to the Vietnam War, literally, okay? And most people think of, you know, the war on terror, the first Predator appears. Wow, right? When in fact, you know, we had jeeps filled with racks of analog equipment, you know, poised at the edge of the jungle, and then flying, you know, a mile away is a remote-controlled surveillance camera. Okay, that's early drone technology, 1967. We're talking about
mm-hmm.
DARPA, Vietnam War. So imagine. You could not have thought, even in the Vietnam War, even if you had access to those programs, you could not have thought of what the Predator was capable of. That it could fly silently, seamlessly, loiter above a target for, you know, 48 hours, waiting, watching like a predator, and then boom, strike with the precision of a laser-guided missile, which didn't exist,
yeah,
right? You couldn't have thought of that before it came out, and then boom, there it is. So what are those things now? And that's what the scientists said to me. They said, before you start, you know, thinking that DARPA is so nefarious, don't forget, China has a DARPA, Russia has a DARPA. What are they working on?
Yeah.
And what's their predator drone that could come out and strike? And that's where you really see what the military-industrial complex is.
Have you seen kind of a shift? It seems to me that DARPA, when you were reading earlier or talking about some of their visions, that it sounds all great, sounds like it's good, and it's all puppies and rainbows. but the implications behind it is staggering. Do you think all of this is an example of hiding all of this stuff in plain sight, that the public is being told that they're doing mind control without being told they're doing mind control, if that makes sense?
I don't. That's a good question. I mean, you're saying, like, what's even worse than mind control?
Well, on top of that, and yeah, and going back to what you said, is that you've obviously been able to piece together from interviews and people who are willing to talk and documents and statements and all of the publicly available information that you've been able to collect. You've been able to tell an amazing story in the Pentagon's brain, but you've already brought up now the fact that there is a huge classified aspect to DARPA. So my question is this an example of they're hiding their research in plain sight and telling you what they're doing? Or do you think this is 5% of the story and 95% is absolutely mind-blowing because we just have no idea what they're up to?
Oh, my God. In all of my books, I said that with Area 51, that, you know, and when people were like, my God, you've told us more about Area 51 than which was happened to have been true because I interviewed, you know, 75 men and women who lived and worked at the base, and no one had ever done that before. So, yes, I had 100% more information than was out there. But as I said, it was the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the case of every organization that I have. I mean, Operation Paperclip, 1,400 Nazis. I kind of focused in on, let's say, 20 of them, like the really, really, really bad ones, right? I am absolutely certain that more stories will come out of people that we don't even know about, that are buried, buried, buried. The Pentagon's brain. I mean, I touched upon what I did and what I found out, but you know, little old me. I mean, that's just what I came up with. I mean, I can't wait for the future to find out what the next generation of person that is as enthusiastic and interested and motivated as I am to kind of find these stories out. Imagine what they can find out. And I think that what will end up happening is what the present informs the past. So, like, I interviewed a guy named Michael Goldblatt, who started all of this biological research, okay? And I was stunned that he let me interview him. And he was super interesting, and he had a daughter with a severe disability who is in a wheelchair. And I went to his home and, like, saw how his daughter moved around. And I could see it on a character level why he was doing what he was doing, you know? I could see it, that he wanted brain-machine interface to work for his daughter. That became super interesting, right? But he gave me access to him and his research and information that wasn't out there, that he knew wasn't classified, because he's interested in the world knowing what he did and what his legacy is, okay? Many people will not agree with it. We'll say, my God, he opened Pandora's box, you know? But he wanted to tell his story. And in him showing me where... And this was like, he was talking about the trials and tribulations at DARPA in 2000, trying to get the Pentagon and Congress to fund these programs. They were not interested. And then 9/11 happens, and suddenly in 10/11, he's got everything he wants and more. So then, based on his information, I could go back in time, meaning into the archives, and begin looking for documents that told the story before he showed up.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't really even know to look had Michael Goldblatt not told me what he told me. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. On a historical timeline, because obviously you did write the book Operation Paperclip, as you mentioned, focused in on the scientists through Pentagon's brain, focusing in on DARPA and the scientists of the Jason scientists and so on. Is there a connection historically drawing the line from us inheriting these Nazi scientists, and we all know from the history books that they were doing some pretty crazy stuff. Can you draw a line from that to DARPA today? Meaning, does it all connect?
As I say all the time, it all goes back to the Nazis. I mean, America did not have the national security apparatus that we now have until 1947. That's when everything was restructured. That was the birth of the CIA. That's when the War Department became the Pentagon. I mean, you know, 1947 is like the line in the sand. And now, after that date, America takes pole position. And not only that, America is taking pole position because we must beat back the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You think of that as a line. Well, of course, that has an origin story. And the origin story to that, I believe, as I write in all of my books, was what sets up Paperclip, which was the war hasn't even ended. World War II, this is. It hasn't ended. And we know that the Germans have all the weapons. They have all the advanced weapons from jets to missiles. I mean, my God, they have the V2. No one else has that. They can break, you know, they're just ahead of it. They're 10 years ahead of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so we send our team called Operation Alsace to capture all this technology so that the Russians don't get it. And that's when we realize, well, we might as well take the scientists. And so, think about it. You've got the Russians coming from their side, us coming, the Allies coming from Normandy, and we're just, you know, we're both just crashing down on Berlin, and that entire, you know, massive arsenal of weapons. We all want it. And so everything that we got, we worried about what the Russians got. And I write about so much of what the Russians got because the bomber technology during the war, the Allies could not get over into Poland, for example, okay? We just couldn't make a run there and back safely. And so when the Germans figured that out, this is the end of the war, they started moving their most precious weapons labs, the chemical weapons labs, the biological weapons labs. They started moving them into Poland. And who got Poland? The Russians. The Defense Department was like, oh my God, the Russians have, you know, all that stuff we don't have. And in many ways, they didn't even know what it was.
And do you know what the Russians ended up getting through that?
Well, I'll give you one specific example because mm-hmm. I love specifics, right? Like Dr. Kurt Blom was someone who I write about in Operation Paperclip. I mean, he was so close to the Fuhrer. He had what I called favor from the Fuhrer. He wore this little pin called the Golden Party Badge. He was the Reichsgesundheitsfuhrer. He was in charge of biological weapons for Hitler. I interviewed his son. His son gave me Dr. Blum's many of his books from his library.
Wow.
Dr. Blum, you look him up. I mean, he's got a giant dueling scar. He was tried at Nuremberg in the doctor's trial, and he was acquitted because he was so brilliant. And we got him for Paperclip, except for he was so bad and so well known that we couldn't bring him to America. So we kept him in Europe and in Germany, and we worked with him there, and we worked with him there at that facility called Camp King, okay? Now, Dr. Blum told us, and again, these are declassified documents I examined for Paperclip. Dr. Blum told us, oh, at the end of the war, Hitler had me move my lab into Poland, my biological weapons lab, and that's where I was working on the bubonic plague weapon. And so we, the Americans, were like, oh my God, the Russians now have the biological weapons technology for a bubonic plague weapon. And that's how we justified building a bubonic plague weapon at Camp Dietrich, which we did in the 1950s, based entirely on what Dr. Blum told us.
You just don't...
And that's but one example.
Yeah, I mean, you just don't hear stories like this. You know, that's why I love talking to you, and I could talk to you all day about these types of stories, because they, meaning the government, has done some great stuff, but they have done some dark, sinister things. And you just, I mean, you just never hear about the extent of Paperclip and the Nazi scientists and how much we utilize them. I think it really is just kind of a mind-blowing piece of history, and one that is very rarely told. And I'm glad you're telling it in the books that you've done so. Now, one thing in the last 10 minutes or so that I have you today, I want to talk a little bit about something that was brought up in a Washington Post review of your book. Obviously positive. Your book got great reviews all around. And they talked about how DARPA played a role in harsh interrogation techniques. Can you talk a little bit about kind of that role and what they played?
Well, I mean, you know, metaphorically, look at it this way. It goes back to what I said, where we have to do, this is the self-licking ice cream code. This is the military-industrial complex. This is the justification for what the enemy is doing. I mean, I've interviewed countless pilots, for example, who've told me, who do not believe waterboarding is torture. And they've said to me, Annie, I've been waterboarded. Come on, right?
Mm-hmm.
They say the reason that they have been waterboarded is because the government needs to know what the enemy will be able to get out of me, the pilot, when I'm waterboarded.
Yeah.
Okay? So there's no question that DARPA's early technologies that go back into some of the, you know, some of the MK Ultra programs have to do with enhanced interrogation.
For audience sake, I want to bring up that we haven't chatted about, but very quickly, Annie had brought up about the MK Ultra experiments. They were using LSD and hypnosis, the combination of both, to essentially extract information. Nowadays, with the research that you've uncovered with implanting chips and devices and so on, do you believe that DARPA research then, with the implantation of those devices, can then turn off the walls that allow somebody to be that patriot who's not going to talk, it doesn't matter about pain? It goes then beyond waterboarding to extract information. Now you just put a little chip in someone's brain and it turns off whatever unwillingness you have to cooperate, or turns on your, you know, pain receptors and makes you think you're just an excruciating amount of pain and you don't waste a drop of water. Do you think that that's where they have gone, or do you know firsthand if that's where they've gone?
You can read in the Pentagon's brain that that's precisely where they've gone in many ways. And that's the man in charge of that program, Michael Goldblatt, told me all about that. Like, and again, this goes back to the early 2000s, like, you know, figuring out drugs that can make people sleep like a bear, mm-hmm. where they almost hibernate. You know, the point you brought up where you can have so much cortisol coming out of you that you don't need water, right? So that does exist, and if that stuff is the unclassified parts, you can only imagine.
Yeah.
But I do, one of the things that I must say is free will, in my belief system, always prevails, right? Now, maybe that's the naive part of Annie Jacobson, but that's why I end up having such an intriguing time interviewing the scientists that I do, because I try to work with people that are willing to work with me for 100 hours, mm-hmm. not one, you know? And we get into those conversations about free will versus, you know, what you can turn someone into. So even a willing participant, even the tier one operator who is willing to volunteer to be what you might shorthand super soldier, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to be the soldier who's going to go on a singleton mission into Iran by myself, you know, literally something along the lines of Jason Bourne, okay? But the real version of that.
Mm-hmm.
That person is willing to do that. But at the end of the day, that the unpredictability of that always falls back to man's free will. And I think that that's another side of all of the books that I write, because ultimately people are humans. And you do end up seeing, I have seen in every book, where there's different scientists who have a turn of perspective. And a lot of times they take their research with them in that other direction, which leads to areas that are unforeseen.
Now, just for clarity, when you say free will prevails, are you saying that you don't think, no matter how good the technology gets, that DARPA could ultimately fully 100% control the human mind in that way? Is that what you mean?
I think so. Yes. Yes,
okay.
I do. I do believe, right? And I do, I mean, you know, that's where artificial intelligence literally becomes spooky. And
yeah.
That's where I would say they're going, because they realize, okay, you know what, you can't, at the end of the day, you're right. The guy is going to make, the man, the human's going to make the decision,
mm-hmm.
no matter what. You know, no, I'm not pushed. I write about a couple of so close to nuclear warfare situations because the machine screws up in the Pentagon's brain. It'll just shock you. And the machine screws up, but the man in the system, right, because so far still the man has to push the button,
mm-hmm.
the human, right? The man goes, wait a minute, I'm not pushing that button, and makes the extra call. And I write a couple times where you're literally, when I mean, you're just like, oh my God, how could that have almost happened, right? But it didn't happen because of the human. And so the thought of artificial intelligence, I'm not talking about your iPhone, you know, Siri answering you. We're talking about true artificial intelligence. That is frightening. And every major thinker that I've interviewed, and I've interviewed a lot of them, agrees with that. But that is deadly and dangerous and should not happen. And yet the DOD continues to pursue that. So I do think that, and the defense science, the defense contractors continue to pursue that because that's where the money is. And I think that is existentially frightening. And I'm certainly not alone in that thought.
No, it is frightening. I am fascinated by that topic. It's a show in itself. But I think what most people don't realize about AI and artificial intelligence is, especially from a defensive aspect, is you don't need to make the perfect AI. You just need to make it good enough to learn from itself. And the minute it starts to learn from itself, it makes its own self better and starts cloning itself. And it goes on from there. I mean, I've done a couple different television shows where I've talked about this, and I'm sad for those listeners who listened to my last interview with Dr. Seth Shostak. I didn't get an opportunity to bring it up, but the AI world is absolutely terrifying. And the minute you start bridging, which I know they are, but the computer chips and AI into the human brain, and all of a sudden you have thinking machines. Again, you don't have to make it perfect. You just have to make it good enough. And it will then take the next step on its own. The implications behind that are absolutely ridiculously frightening and staggering. The Pentagon's Brain is the book. We've been talking about that mostly, but obviously Annie has written quite a few that I would urge you to check out. I want to read this, Annie, for my audience so they know. The Pulitzer Prize, you were a 2016 finalist in the history category. This is what they said about the Pentagon's Brain. A brilliantly researched account of a small but powerful secret government agency whose military research profoundly affects world affairs. Mother Jones calls your book fascinating and terrifying, which seems like you and I probably agree with that. And Publishers Weekly, fascinating, unsettling, truly remarkable. Most anticipated books of fall of 2015. It's definitely worth the read. I urge you all to go out and get it. Annie's website is www.annie.jacobsen.com. And of course, you can reach all of these links on the show notes page for this at www.theblackvault.com/show notes. I will link to all of Annie's books, her website, and some of the things that we have talked about. Annie, lastly, what is next for you? Any new books on the horizon that you can tease us with, or any public appearances other than your website that people can reach yet? What's next for you?
I have a book publishing in May, which is perhaps the most exciting book I have written to date, and it is about the CIA's paramilitary armies, operators, and assassins.
Wow.
The name of the book is Surprise, Kill, Vanish.
Wow, Surprise, Kill, Vanish.
And the reason that's the name is because that was the motto of the OSS when they were set about to kill Nazis. Jump out of airplanes and kill Nazis. And that is the origin story of my new book, Surprise, Kill, Vanish.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Again, that book, Surprise, Kill, Vanish. Annie, I hope that you will spend a little bit of time with us next year when that's released and we can dive into that together. It's been a fascinating hour. I want to personally thank you. I know, like I said in the beginning, you're very, very busy right now doing about 32,000 things a day. So I do appreciate you joining me on the Black Vault Radio.
Keep up the good work. It's wonderful to see your information growing.
I appreciate that, and thank you. Although that concludes my interview with Annie Jacobsen, don't go away. Coming up, I profile a document that shows just how far the research and development of DARPA goes. That's next on TBV Unredacted. This episode's TBV Unredacted. I want to keep with the theme of DARPA. As I told Annie on the last segment, I could talk to her all day about DARPA. There's a lot about that agency that I don't know and the general public doesn't know.
Annie's done a lot of work, but as she said, there is just so much more to discover about that agency. One document that that I discovered back in 2014 actually is indicative of what type of research DARPA has done, going back all the way to the, you know, 70s and well before that, about what they wanted to accomplish. Now, we obviously focus on the last segment about brain research and implants and potentially what they call mind control, depending upon your definition of mind control. DARPA is doing a lot of things, some for good, some for bad, some we just don't know. And this particular document, again, that I had discovered in 2014, from my recollection here, looking at the document, this had never seen the light of day before. This was actually something that was done, a study done by RAND that was prepared for DARPA. And this was about researching of an electron beam system, or a weapon that shot an electron beam from space to Earth, apparently, that could be used as an actual weapon. Now, this really brings up the thoughts about the Star Wars program and things that we were doing, but this was something different. And like Annie had talked about, DARPA was looking for ultimately weapons and things for defense, aggression, war. That's what they have done for decades, and they have done it on multiple facets. So I thought I would bring up this one particular document just to kind of show you guys what has come out. Now, this was formerly secret. Yes, this was declassified for my Freedom of Information Act request. So this had never seen the light of day before. I just found the declassification stamp here while I'm talking about it. So again, formerly secret, got it declassified a few years back. So it's all about the electron beam weapon. They called it the Electro Ring. So let me kind of just read here for you a section of it that kind of outlines exactly what they were trying to do. So let me go ahead and if you want to download this document while I talk about it, by the way, it's www.theblackvault.com/show notes. You are listening to episode number 19. Just go ahead and look for the TBV Unredacted segment link. That will go ahead and link over to this document. This is what the summary is. It says electron beams are examined for potential use as space radiation weapons. Active, semi-active sensors, energy storage and transfer mechanisms, and communication media. Use of 7 GeV electrons as a weapon against in-space reentry warheads is investigated with a mission labeled SPEAR. Prospective methods for generating such electrons are considered. Analogous use of proton beams is briefly reviewed. Future high-power lasers and particle beam systems will require spaceborne energy supplies, and then it starts to go into some of the math of how much energy is needed. Such energy must be readily convertible to high power for beam weapons, radars, and similar uses. Storage by means of electron kinetic energy in a storage ring appears to be a prospect for meeting this objective at a reasonable weight compatible with space systems support. Pulse nuclear devices have been proposed for space power, but lightweight mechanization of this concept has not been formulated. A chemical laser, for example, would require 500 to 50,000 tons of fuel for the above energies. Now, it obviously goes into much more detail. The document is 71 pages long and really kind of outlines what DARPA was doing. Now, I don't want to go into too much depth because it is technical in nature. But at the end of the day, what I wanted you guys to realize was how in-depth the studies of DARPA are going. And this was from the 70s. So it really puts into perspective, and that's what I was saying in the segment with Annie, but I'll say it again. Historical context and documents, even though they're from decades ago, lends credence to believing the more wild theories of today. It makes you realize that space-based weapons and laser systems and chemical lasers and all of this crazy technology was being researched 30, 40 plus years ago. And not only was it being researched, but it's considered feasible, even though at the time it may not have been very feasible.
as technology progresses, as we get more into the 21st century, science progresses, discoveries are made, all of a sudden something that was impossible in 1970s is now possible in 2018 or 2019 because of the advances of science. And I think that that plays a role into a lot of this type of research with the government and the military. When they do this type of research, they may come up with a conclusion that at that time, it's quote-unquote impossible. But as discoveries are made and time goes on, all of a sudden what was impossible is now very possible. And you look at a document like this, now you don't need to spend the money anymore. You spent the money in the 70s, you researched a space-based weapon, laser system, or particle beam or electron beam weapon, not feasible then. Well, all the money's done. It's spent. The report is made. We know how to do it, but at the time we just couldn't do it. Fast forward a couple decades. Now all of a sudden, all the research is still done, but the impossibility is now gone. That it is now possible to create that space-based weapon laser system or the electron beam weapon system and put that into space and implement it at a fraction of the cost. You can hide those costs in budgets that are hundreds of billions or in excess of $1 trillion. You don't need to do all the R&D anymore because it was done in the 70s. So that is what is fascinating to me, because you look at this, some may dismiss it and go, well, that's interesting, but that was 1970s, you can't do it. But think deeper. Think along the lines that, yes, now they probably can do it. All the research is done, and to implement it is a fraction of the cost than researching it and then implementing it. And those types of costs can, again, be hidden when you're talking about budgets of hundreds of billions or in excess of $1 trillion. Absolutely mind-blowing episode with Annie. Very, very excited that she spent the time with me today. I know she is very busy. She's obviously getting out that new book, writing for the new series that you can see on Amazon Prime, Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. Make sure you tune into that. So thanks to her for taking that time, and make sure you look in to not only this document, but many others that have come out about DARPA and what they're doing. Because sometimes you just hide things in plain sight. Put a fancy title on it. Do mind control, but don't say it's mind control. Make it for the veterans, or make it for the animals, or make it for world peace, or make it for climate change, or whatever you might be doing. But just know that deep down, there's probably a more sinister agenda. That's pretty much a safe bet. That being said, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope if you do enjoy it, you will consider subscribing. If you want to do so via the YouTube channel, which I ask that you do subscribe, there's a lot of content coming in addition to this radio show. That's at www.theblackvault.com/originals. That will forward you over to that YouTube channel. And of course, the show notes page will link you to every button that you will need to subscribe to the podcast stream. That's at www.theblackvault.com/show notes. This may be the last episode of this year. We're going to see how it goes through the holiday season, not only for myself, but also guests. It gets a little bit challenging to schedule a guest through the holidays. So if I don't talk to you before the end of the year, Merry Christmas to you. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Christmas Kwanzaa. Whatever you celebrate, make sure that you are happy, you are safe, you are with your family, and if you travel, have safe travels. And I really do appreciate you listening to this program and subscribing. And if you even feel so inclined, feel free to throw a review up there on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening on. It is a huge help. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off, quite possibly for the last time in 2018. We'll see you next time.